This is Corolla Digital.
Hey, it's Chris Loxamana here, and there's a new episode of Resume out now. This week, I have the Plain White Tees on the show, and they talk about some of the old jobs they had before starting the band.
I started at Subway. I was a sandwich artist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Girl who worked there named Katrina, who tried to castrate me while we were on the ship. She grabbed a knife off the shelf and just put it between my legs and said, "I'm going to cut your dick off." And then I tossed her through a bread shelf, neither one of us got fired.
You can find it on iTunes, the Corolla Digital app, or chrisloxamana.com. Once again, the podcast is called Resume, and it's right here on Corolla Digital.
It is the Dr. Drew podcast. That is the groovy sounds that attracted Paul Mercurio to want to come back to the show again.
Yes. It's I have my ascot on.
Swinging Sounds, the Dr. Drew podcast, volume 1, 2, and 3 on iTunes, drdrew.com/music. Be sure to click through on the Amazon banner and support the pirate ship and support the sponsors of these shows. All right. So Paul and I had such a good time last time. I hope you all feel like I do. I could listen to his stories all day. And this now... Forget going back to podcast 152. We're going to flush out a little more what we touched out in that particular podcast.
Okay.
We went from Rhode Island, from living at the furniture store in college and getting into investment banking.
Yeah.
If you guys did not hear that podcast, you need to listen to that one. Although this will be – I'm sure this will stand alone on its own merit. But really – there was a lot of information about Cousin Benny. And
Cousin Bobby.
Cousin Bobby. And
my Uncle Benny. And the endless – not having a pony or Jell-O.
Tina and her craziness.
The least you could do is get me Jell-O or a little pony to put up here that I could look at. It's a reference to the previous episode. But.
Okay. So I don't know. Let's see where we left off. We left off. We had two things we wanted to get into. One was when you're working and writing for the Daily Show and for Stephen Colbert and all kind of stuff, and how you ended up with all the great guests you had on your podcast.
You want me to tell the Paul McCartney story?
Well, not yet. Which include the Paul McCartney, Jay Leno, Stephen Colbert. You got to see the Paul Mercurio podcast. Also, by the way, the Paul Mercurio Show available on iTunes and on Paul's website, which is Paul Mercurio, no R, M E C U R I O, PaulMercurio.com. Twitter handle's at Paul Mercurio. I want to go forward from the investment banking.
Yeah.
So you're doing investment banking. You told the story about doing this amazing film that went to the Aspen Film Festival. I had no idea you met with filmmakers like Albert Brooks and Woody Allen. And so now that piece, interestingly, unlocked something for me as I understand your story, because I can never understand the jokes and how you got to the first step when you gave the Leno the jokes. Now that makes sense to me. You made a film because kids have these – you were a young kid and kids have a creative sort of
something thing. Happened. I was living in a basement apartment with one window on a door with a grate on the window in law school in a townhouse in Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., going to Georgetown Law School. And I would lie in bed at night. By the way, had never seen this happen to me before. It was a basement apartment with a garden out back. And I wake up at 2 in the morning to go to the bathroom, and there's a shimmery trail of slime and then this big, gross thing. And it was a slug, and it had come under the door and was making its way across my floor. And I had never seen a slug before.
Really?
I was so freaked out. I couldn't fall asleep the rest of the
day. Just a snail without a shell.
I didn't know. I never was so freaked out. All right. Sorry. I bounce around. I apologize. So I would lie in bed at night. And I'd start to have these short film ideas and sketch ideas.
While you were in law school.
And I have no idea why.
Right. So you had some creative need right there.
Something was going on. I can relate
to that. I remember I myself was never satisfied doing one thing. I always had to be doing different. And so the idea of just sitting in an office and seeing congestive heart failure patients every day, I loved it. But not enough. I had something a little more I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I get that impulse. But once you do it, how that it goes then to inspiration to write more comedy.
Right.
It was really those filmmakers. Is that accurate? Or was
I think it,
it was
now.
That whole
you know,
experience?
I've never really talked about it at length until now. And as I talk about it more, I think it was because I got so energized by that, and sitting in that theater in Aspen and people seeing my film and then laughing and reacting
to it.
Okay,
so there's the laughing again.
And it was like on a big screen, and then my name is up on the screen.
Yeah,
and
it's a big deal. Yeah. You were how old then?
I was, I don't know, 25, 26. Yeah, so just deal. Out a couple of years out of law school.
Something about that 22 to 28 years. Don't ever second guess that age group. Yeah. Whatever they want to do, fine.
Yeah, but I just was like, I had no guidance from anybody. I had nobody in this world. I had a mother and a father, high school educated, brother and sister, college educated.
It's all asset.
It's all.
I don't think that was a detriment. I think that's what kept the. If you'd had somebody telling you what to do,
yeah.
They would not have told you to take the path you took.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
But I think I'm a lot like my mother. As much as I bitch about her, like if you tell me A, I'm going to do B. Yeah. And my mother's very motivated by proving people wrong. Like, you think I can't do this? That's why we think that this business was her college that she couldn't go to. I think she always felt like she could have gone to college,
right.
But they could only afford to send one kid to college. So I basically
was the dentist.
My Uncle John, the racist.
Uncle John, the racist.
The racist chain-smoking, disheveled dentist.
with the shirt tail sticking out of his fly.
Right. You know you hear – this is all true. You know you hear like kids born and then separated at birth and then they live a life like very similar. So my mother and my Uncle John would not see each other. My mother was basically a female version of my Uncle John. She wasn't racist, but she didn't – and she didn't smoke. But otherwise disheveled, crazy, brilliant, like mad scientist.
Interesting.
So they would not see each other for months. Where would they run into each other? At 3 o'clock in the morning in the
trash cans. Digging in trash cans.
In the supermarket. They'd like to both like to shop in the all night supermarket at 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning.
You've got to find out what happened to them in the old country. Something happened.
And then she'd go
Did they grow up in Italy?
And she'd be like, Johnny, what are you doing? And she'd like be dressed, revert back to being 16 and being the mother.
Sure.
And she'd make him zip his pants up and fix his tie and he'd smoke. Yeah. This is where you could smoke anywhere.
Right.
And he was like, there was also a gas shortage. So he would like buy the biggest car that ate the most gas as a fuck you to the gas industry. Like he drove a Chrysler 456.
The early 70s.
So it was like he was out of his mind. Like he was out, but brilliant and incredibly entertaining because he was so brilliant. Like knew the history of calculus. Like really, really, you would totally connect with him. Really bright guy. And so anyway, long story short, my mother and all of that, I think sort of drove me to kind of have that attitude of like, well, I can do whatever I want and no one can tell me. But I got bitten by something and that film getting that recognition was like, holy shit, this is like, whoa.
So now you start writing. How long were you writing before you have that chance to meet Jay Leno?
I probably was writing for, I don't know, like a good year.
So it wasn't that long. So you were still, the wind were blowing hard on you at that point.
Yeah, and I'm writing. And
Were you the whole time like, what do I do with this? How do I write another movie? Were you planning another film?
I was thinking about another film, but I didn't know. I wasn't thinking of it like a feature film.
Woody Allen. Did you ever see the documentary on Woody Allen?
No.
You would need to see the documentary, at least the first part. It's a two-parter.
Mm-hmm.
He basically writes notes and strips them up and just keeps them in a stack, just a bunch of writes stuff down, jokes, ideas, and just goes through them once in a while. And they're all story and film ideas.
Wow.
And he just does that all day long, just writing.
Really?
Yeah.
Anybody rips them in
I remember, if I remember right, what I remember seeing in the movie, it's sort of the shredded up little pieces of notes. Yeah. And then he writes everything on the sort of little portable, you know, manual typewriter from the 30s and still uses the same
typewriter.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. And I was just writing this stuff and I put it in a passworded file at work. I thought it was secret, but it turned out after I left – the guy that ran the IT department said, I would read your jokes. They were really good. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. I knew before anybody else knew.
Oh, shit. Okay. So where was this Leno meeting? What happened with that?
There was a printer called R.R. Donnelly. They, like, if you get a prospectus in the mail, like anything related to your corporation's
the stock report and stuff. The stock certificates.
Yeah. Or stock certificates, prospectus, any of that stuff.
Right.
By the way, for all the sexy stuff, I had to like, you know what slugging is when you read? You have to proofread. You know how you slug is you go along the left side of the column of a paragraph. And if the words match up exactly, then you know there are no typos. And that's
the word. I mean, this.
You look at a paragraph.
I mean, the.
And you look at the left
margin?
Side.
I mean, the margin.
No, you just look at the left side of the beginning of each line, right? So, like, if you're looking at a newspaper, and the line says the car went down the street very fast, and those are three lines.
Yeah.
It's the car. So what you do is you. you're a lawyer, I'm a lawyer. You have the original document and the one that was revised, and I say the words, the car, fast, boom,
sure
boom,
match.
Boom, oh, boom, boom. Do that for 3 hours, and that was the other reason I was getting paid a lot of money.
Don't people learn to game that? Yeah. Screw with some of the internal?
No, that's the one where if you screw that up, you're screwed. Right? So
they need attorneys to do that?
Yeah, because it's a legal document. It's an SEC filing, and you can't trust that to a paralegal.
Right.
And that's why there was pressure. Like, you know, you go to Georgetown Law School and you can't get that right. You're out on your ass, right? Yeah. So this printer had these printers made a boatload of money. A boatload of money because they're biggest corporations of the world were their clients. Mm-hmm. And this is R.R. Donnelly who had like the lion's share. And they had a new grand opening of their corporate headquarters. And Jay Leno was a private entertainment, 150 people, exclusive. I wasn't going to go. I was swamped.
Where was it?
This was downtown on Wall Street.
Where?
At the like 3 Wall Street, whatever the exact address, but on Wall Street, like literally like
where the Bull is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like 3 blocks up from the Bull.
Yeah.
Yeah, like right there in the heart of it. So I'm like, come on, we got a town car waiting, let's go. I'm like, all right, I'll just take an hour and come back and pull another all-nighter. And I put my jacket on. And I remember this day, I stand up from my desk and I got my keyboard there and I'm like, fuck it. And I hit the print button and I printed out the jokes.
How many were there?
There must have been 12 pages of jokes.
Okay.
I mean, so
like
I don't,
single space.
Yeah, single space paragraph.
80 there jokes must, a page kind of
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, no, there must have been a total of like well over 100, 120 jokes. Yeah, a lot of jokes.
Okay.
A lot. And I just go and I basically have it folded up in my breast pocket and I'm like obsessed with being able to talk to him. I'm not really.
Oh, you get an idea now. Now you think.
Now I'm at the place and he's performing.
Oh, in the middle of the performance.
Yeah,
the light goes off.
I'm like, I got to talk to him. Yeah. I got to talk to him. I got to give him this. So I'm not really hearing his jokes anymore. I'm just like, I got to. It's like, wah, 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 wah. And I basically.
All you see is a giant chin up there.
Yeah, exactly. And just moving. And then I go up to him and I'm like, he comes off and he's like, it's meet and greet. You know, I think it's part of like what he had to do and shake his hand and. I'm like a big fan, and he's like, and he really talks like they're letting helium out of a balloon very slowly. And I go, I have jokes, and I did it really quietly. Like, I actually asked him to come over to like one side a little bit. I'm like, could you come here for a minute? And he's like, I go, I have jokes, and I kind of whispered, like, I don't know what to do with them. I wrote them, but if you want them, you can have them. And he's like, yeah, you wrote them? I go, yeah. He goes, all right, yeah. And I walk away, and he goes, hey, come back here. I go, what? He goes, you might want to write your name and your phone number on me so I know how to reach you. I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
And takes him. And I'll never forget, he put him like right in his inside. I remember seeing it.
Like a shirt pocket?
No, in his breast pocket of his jacket. Yeah. Like it was yesterday, you know? 2 days later.
When was this?
When was it?
Yeah. Year, approximately.
I mean, I'm in my like third year of law right now. So, second year. I'm going to move over to investment banking. So I go home.
What year?
What year? This would be like 95-ish.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
96.
Okay.
No, actually later, like late 90s, because then I kicked into this like early 2000s. So late 90s. And basically, I forget about it. And 3 days later, there's a bunch of messages. My girlfriend, now my wife, had taken, you know, your mother called, is dry cleaning ready? Jay Leno called.
And I'm like, she didn't think anything weird of that? does she know who Jay Leno is?
She goes, yeah, but she was like, Jay Leno called. Like, and I think she thought it was a friend pranking me, right? And I'm like, what? I go, is this for real? She goes, yeah. She goes, but I think it's Peter. This is a friend of ours. Yeah. And it's like a number. But it was like, I think it was a 323. It was like a California. I didn't recognize the area code. It wasn't New York area code.
310.
Yeah, 310 or something. And I'm like, all right. Jay Leno. I'm like, Peter?
No, you didn't.
Yeah. Oh. He goes, no, it's Jay Leno. I go, no, it's Peter, right? You're jerking me, right? He goes, no, who is this? I go, this is Paul McCurry. He goes, yeah, you gave me the jokes the other night.
Oh.
I'm like,
did you just evacuate your bowels at that point?
My mouth. Never got so dry so fast all my life.
Yeah.
And this is like I'm doing merger deals with T. Boone Pickens, and I got He goes, yeah, I read your stuff. I read your stuff. Said, yeah, pretty good, pretty good. He goes, I need jokes for the Tonight Show monologue.
Did you keep these jokes at all?
They're somewhere. They're in a file somewhere.
Seems like they should be like.
Yeah. I kept the first check he ever gave me. Big Dog Productions, $50. Xeroxed a check. You know, I never Xeroxed the first check I got from Wall Street.
Right.
But I Xeroxed that $50 check and I have it framed. And
for those of you who don't know what Xerox is, it's a copy.
Oh, sorry. Well, no, they have Xerox. That date
copying
me?
Machines, you know?
We mimeographed
it. You're right. They have no idea what that is. So anyway, so Jay calls, good jokes.
Yeah, and he goes, I'll start sending stuff in and I'll pay you. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? Yeah. He goes, you just send them over to me, email them, fax them. I don't care.
Email. Yeah. Did we have email then?
Yeah, it was like just starting. It was mainly fax, though. Yeah. He goes, fax, and then we, And I'm like, okay. He goes, I'll pay you $50 a joke. He goes, don't leave your job. This isn't like a full-time staff job. He goes, but if I use something, I'll pay you. And I go, okay, well, thank you very much. I don't know what, like I was like just letting him lead the conversation. And then I go, he goes, what do you do for a living? I go, I'm a lawyer. He goes, he goes, I knew it. I go, why? He goes, you're too wordy. Your setups are way too long. He goes, you write like a lawyer. Cut your shit back. And that's how it started. And then a week later, he called me again, himself. Hey, Jay Leno here. No, I get a call. Hold for Jay Leno.
Oh.
Hey, I'm going to do one of your jokes tonight. I'm like, why are you calling me? Like, just don't you have somebody who has somebody who has somebody?
What do you say?
He goes, I like to keep in touch with the guys, see how they're doing, whatever. See if you have any questions. I'm like, no. He goes, by the way, don't send me any motorcycle jokes. He goes, I'm a motorcycle freak. He goes, and you have jokes like where you want to run over the guys that cut through traffic. I'm not going to do that joke ever. I'm like, all right, well, stop cutting through traffic. I said, fucking assholes. I actually said that to him. I was like, holy shit, I think I just lost my job. And then that night he did the joke. I had a bottle of champagne with my girlfriend and another couple, and we popped the thing, and he did the joke. And it blew my head off my shoulders.
Was this another out-of-body experience?
Yeah. It was on par with seeing the film
and
then being in that room with those filmmakers.
So those dots connect.
Yeah, and it was like, whoa. Like, this is like, holy shit. And then that really like lit a fire where I was writing obsessively and sending stuff in and getting stuff on and writing. And then it kind of got to the point of like, he said, go try the jokes out before you send them to me. And that's when I started to sneak out of work and I go to these dive bars around New York City.
What was the first one you did?
The first bar?
Yeah.
It was, one was just a little like P.J. Clark's downtown. It had like a
PJ
little.
P.J. Clark's by the music center, by the Lincoln Center?
No, farther downtown on the lower,
the other
on
one.
The east side, like in the 20s. Yeah. And they had like a little room in the back and some person had an open mic night.
How did you find out about it?
Well, Leno was the one that gave me the guidance. He said, go to one of the main clubs and ask the established comedians or the manager and they'll know about like little open mic rooms where the newbies are getting to get cut their, figure their stuff out and try stuff out. And that's what I did. And they would go down and I would go down.
Are you friends with Leno still?
Hmm?
You friends with Leno still?
Yeah, I can call him up. Yeah. I got his number.
He did your podcast.
Yeah. I just don't abuse the privilege, you know?
He's a funny guy. He's a polarizing guy. People either really like him or really hate him.
I think I know why, but I could be wrong. I think that as a comic, he was really great, like edgy and smart. He had a joke about Chicken McNuggets. He said, I tried these Chicken McNuggets. He goes, you can put a box of Chicken McNuggets on the ground. A chicken could walk up to this box, look inside and say, I see nothing offensive here. Now, that's a good, smart joke.
Yeah.
On a premise that's been done a million times, right? So you know a comic's good if you can either take an original premise and be funny or take a dead premise and make it funny and original. But when he got on The Tonight Show and he said it to me, he goes, you know, we're like McDonald's. We want to serve as many millions as we can. So to do that, you have to broaden your comedy to appeal to, you know, like older people that like it safe and whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that's what polarized him in terms of the entertainment comedy community. It was like some people felt like he should have just stuck to who he was. And then also the way I think he came about getting the job.
It bothered people.
Well, you know, look, that's business.
Yeah.
And nobody makes it to the heights of business being a Boy Scout.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you don't. Now, I'm not justifying it. But
by a Boy Scout, you don't mean necessarily being unethical, but not being unaggressive.
Yes.
You've got to be aggressive.
Now, whether or not he was unethical, that's open for debate, right?
Right, but he was certainly
aggressive.
Because
if you hide in a closet and listen to a conversation, I don't know if that's unethical. It's bizarre.
As I remember the story, I don't remember very well. Did he intend to listen, or he sort of ended up in a closet and happened to listen?
I think the way I remember it, he intended to. But, you know, I saw what went on. I saw the machinations that went on at my firm. You know, literally, like, one partner sleeping with another partner, and then suddenly, you know, that partner's on a committee that she never, like, I'm not saying I'm justifying it, but, like, one of the things that some, especially comics, like to do is, oh, I'm just a dumb cluck comic and I tell jokes and I don't know anything. Bullshit. You don't make it that far in the business being a dumb cluck comic.
Yeah.
You don't.
Yeah.
That's disingenuous to me.
Yeah.
Like, if you make it that far.
That far, meaning Leno far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're at the top of the food chain. Listen how savvy he was, right? Mm. At the time, I don't know if you remember, when Johnny Carson would take breaks, he'd rotate Gary Shandling, Jay Leno, and
Joan Rivers.
And Joan Rivers, they had a fight.
They'd always gone there.
Okay. Right. Yeah. So it was Letterman, Shandling, and Leno were the rotating guest hosts. That's it. And at one point, one of the reps of one of the other guys went to Leno's reps and said, we want to band together, because they were just getting scale, like $545 a week for appearance. And we want to, like, demand, like, real money for this. And Leno goes, you guys do what you want to do. He goes, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
I go, why not? I go,
because
you know what?
Lifetime.
You make yourself expendable when you start putting a big price tag on. He goes, they like what I do. It's a great job. I don't want to give them a reason to fire me.
Yeah.
That is not a dumb cluck comic.
Yeah.
That's a guy that understood. The other thing that he did was he was affiliate friendly. So he would go around. He was working in Tucson, Arizona. They'd ask him to go to the NBC affiliate. He'd go. Letterman, not a fucking million years. So, you know, Letterman made his bed. You got to lie in it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he was not corporate friendly, not just shitting on the corporate suits on air, which they all do, but, like, not playing ball. Leno figured out at the end of the day, while, you know, everybody thinks they're making art, they're generating income for a major corporation to have to answer to shareholders. And if you are going to work with that business team in a constructive way. And those are all the things. Now, that doesn't make him a bad person. That just makes him a good businessman, you know. So I just think he could have kept his edge of his comedy and still connected. But
I don't know why Stern hates him so much. I don't get it.
I don't know, man. I think that, you know, I think the way he got the job.
Well, I know something else. Maybe they had a falling out or something together. I don't know.
I don't know.
I've heard other people, they don't like
him. The whole thing with Conan after that, I don't think that helped
and
him.
But I have other people just love him, just think he's just so genuine. And the story you tell is very genuine.
Well, he was.
He's bringing up a young comic.
Yeah,
here,
he was. And he was accessible. And when I called him to do my podcast, he did it.
Adam flies with it. He throws him on his plane if he's happened to be in the same area and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not one of these guys just going to jump on a bandwagon because other people have a problem with him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's good to me and, you know, accessible. I don't try to bother him too much. I think that's why I'm accessible.
I really confused me because I generally really trust Howard Stern's instincts. They're usually exquisitely solid.
Mm.
And I'm wondering what's bothering him so much.
Did they have a
personal thing or that maybe Leno won't ever come on.
Letterman
finally came on with him on his birthday.
On Stern. But I know that he and Letterman are pretty tight in that way.
Oh, are they?
So maybe it's just he sided with Letterman over that thing. You know what
maybe
I mean?
Maybe Letterman fed him some information.
I also think that there was a – I mean, I don't know. You know, it starts to get like stories on top of stories.
Yeah,
and you don't know where the real story begins and the bullshit begins after ends or whatever. But like – so, yeah. I mean, it was just like – this was now like this period of just like all – things, cylinders
comedy.
Going.
So you know, you go to PJ Cox. What was that like?
A nervous wreck. I was just like, holy shit, what am I doing here? And like,
could you do it?
I did it, and I don't think I was very good.
How long did you go for?
You had 5 minutes. I went.
Did you get
five
laughs?
I got one laugh, and then I just remember like my mouth was really dry, and I was just like kind of. There was like a lot of pausing because I was like taking the room in. It was literally like, and then you could hear
your heartbeat. Boom,
yeah, and
boom.
Then you could hear like clang of the like the dishes, and then they had a blender at the. Somebody's like ordering a margarita. Like you can hear all of that shit, right?
Yeah.
And then I started to branch out to other rooms, you know. And then like there was this one room, a regular room that I talked about, which was called Downtown Beirut 2, which was like this really. Bad divey place.
Well, before you get to that story, I just wondered, did you have success anywhere? Like, anything that really propelled you forward before you get to the downtown Beirut situation?
I make like small incremental gains, you know, like you know, like I would go back to PJ Clark's, and then there was a place like in Queens that I went to. It was another like restaurant with a room in the back, and you know, and then I started to go out to a place called the Callaloo Cafe in Morristown, New Jersey. And it was a nice little room where people came to see the comedy, and it was at the beneath the restaurant. So it was quiet. You didn't hear all the restaurant noise and chatter. And I started to do well there, like on a regular basis. And I was like, oh, I think I got this. And then I had a really depressing conversation with, and now in retrospect, was a bitter alcoholic fucking asshole comic.
Who was it?
At Dangerfields. I can't remember his name. And if I could, I would say it in a heartbeat. And he saw me at Dangerfields, which is like, it's a club that time forgot. It literally is on the 61st and 1st Avenue, and they haven't changed the decor in 70 years. Like, literally, they're these like old, angry waiters that wear those little red jackets, and there's a little red, lampshades. Yep. It's like, it looks like a bad lounge from Atlantic City in the 70s, literally.
Yeah.
And I remember asking the guy for feedback because was very much about like, help me be better.
Yeah.
And he goes, and there's like two established comics. It was, I don't know, George Carlin and somebody else.
Wow.
He goes, you see George Carlin, you see this guy? He goes, and there was like about literally an inch of space between the two edges of the frame. He goes, you're that guy right there. And he points to the blank wall in between the two frames. And I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, you're not really anything right now. You're just that
right now.
And
I'm
like,
supposed to be.
And I was just like, you fucking asshole. Like, and this is the part of it was always hard.
That shouldn't even have bothered you, though. I mean, because that's just a guy, dick being a dick.
Yeah, but like, I didn't know. Like, I was so innocent. Yeah. Like, I said, like, even the other night, like, sometimes something happens. Like,
Did you play football in high school or anything?
I was a swimmer growing up.
You need your balls busted a little bit.
Oh, no, I got my balls busted. Right. But like, comedy to me was
not
like,
just by your mom, I mean by other guys.
No, but you have to understand that there's a part about comedy that people who aren't in it don't understand. They say this to me. It must be so much fun being a comedian.
No.
You hang out with other comics and everybody's so fun and happy and joking all the time. No.
Louis kind of captures that a little bit when you see him walking off the stage and stuff.
Yeah, you don't understand. And that's the part that kind of – still to this day I have to be careful for not to get me jaded and bummed out about being a comic because I just thought comedy was the balls. It was fun and these people were funny. And I do these impressions of like Rodney Dangerfield jokes at school and high school and I get laughs in the locker room and people thought I was really funny and I was starting to tell like jokes and then I was the MC at the – homecoming day parade and I had a funny hat. I was doing like funny skits and interesting. So like there was like and then once I start to meet these people behind the facade I'd be like ugh, like what you know.
So I'm seeing something a little new that I hadn't seen before, which is that you enjoyed performing in high school and stuff like that because it filled you. I got voted
class clown.
It filled you in a way that other things didn't.
Yeah.
Mom.
Yeah. And vaginas. I had no vaginas anywhere near my
penis.
That's
always important to be with comedy. but that you saw the comedy as sort of Disneyland, you know, sort of your – escape, you know.
It was the one thing they let me stay up late to watch.
But I get the feeling that you had, which is I know how else to describe it. Like, it was it took you away.
Yeah,
it took you away, and you expected it when you got in it to be swept away.
And
I think that
something happened with me when I started to get those laughs in high school.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I could be.
I think a lot of other people describe this kind of phenomena with applause too.
Mm.
Well, take people they are in love with it.
Yeah.
They fall in love with that. And they're in love with the – and what gets them up there is being in love with the people that they're being taken away by.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like I started to become more popular as a result of disability. And I was like an average kid popular. I mean, you know, I wasn't
It all kind of fits together. Dots kind of fit together. Yeah. But the rocket fuel, it sounds like, still is that Aspen experience.
Yeah, and I never thought about that. I thought it was Leno, but you're right. Before that, it was that, you know. And,
yeah, Leno was stuck on the afterburner.
And by the way, before that, what it probably was I made a couple of short films for one of the comedy clubs because I had a friend who was a comedian.
Uh-huh.
And we made a couple of short films for the comedy club Comic Strip Christmas Party, and that got played. Mm-hmm. And the people in the room were laughing at was put it on VHS tape. Hello. Yeah,
of course. Or beta.
And then boom, that thing gets like seen and people start laughing at that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was like it was just like one brick getting built on put on top of another brick, but I didn't realize it. And
right,
it probably all started
not.
Like in high school.
And probably you were probably afraid of it too because it was threatening your career.
Well,
which made your mom and dad so proud, and made you money and all this stuff.
Yeah, it was definitely
scary.
Yeah, it was scary, and so I basically just am like riding this weird wave that sort of suddenly, and I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm thinking, oh, this is just a hobby, and I'll play golf and shit like that. You know, like some people play golf. This is my golf, right? This is my thing, but I just keep doing it. And then, you know, work in shitty bars and this and that. And then eventually, I mean, we don't have to get into the downtown movie two story.
I want you to.
All right, okay.
Now's the time.
and basically, one of the regular places I worked was downtown Beirut 2. And it was literally called downtown Beirut 2. And it was literally like a dysfunctional Cheers. You know, they had like there was a hooker worked out of there who, by the way, she would give you notes on your jokes. You'd come off stage and go, awesome. You know, how come you're not doing that joke about the taxi cabs? I'm like, what? She goes, I like that joke. Oh, the ending isn't there yet. She would literally give you notes. And I'm like, it was like, now I look back and it's like, it's well, it could be part of the show that we're developing.
I was going to say, no, that's another sitcom.
Yeah, right? And then and her pimp worked out of there and they dealt drugs out of there.
Wow.
And it got so bad that they had a sign on the men's room door that said the toilet seat is only to be used to go to the bathroom, not to cut coke. Thank you, the manager.
Wow. Crazy.
And I never forget the sink, the hot faucet of the men's sink never turned off. So there was always like a trickle.
Of hot water.
And I can always remember going in there, like the banker and me going, this is going to be costing them a shit ton of money.
I said they get fined in California.
It was a pool table in the middle and they had this bar and everybody, it was poets, folk singers, and comedians. And you pick a number. And my routine was everybody else was going for dinner break at 7 o'clock from the firm. I'm getting in a town car and changing my clothes a little bit, taking my tie off in the car and taking my suit, leaving it, and having the guy drop me a block in the dark shadows.
So you basically pull your shirt tails out.
Pull my shirt tails out. Roll my sleeves up. Yeah. Unbutton my button and mess up my hair and try to look, quote unquote, downtown.
Yeah.
And hang out there in my Brooks Brothers slacks and my wingtip shoes that my father would have worn taking me fishing. And I'd sit there and wait to go on. And some nights you get a number early. And the whole stress was, what number am I going to get? Am I going to get a low number or a high number?
Why?
Because you get a high number, then you got to sit there through 25 comics.
And would you go back to work and come back or something of that?
No, I'd just stay because sometimes they'd jump and they'd pull, so I'd stay. And then I'd start to have to like call in and be like, oh, you know,
I'm coming,
whatever. I'm on a conference call. I had so many lies going. I was on a conference call, stuck on an elevator, like all this stuff. And I basically, one night waiting to go on stage, and there's this huge dude with like a cobra tattooed on the back of his head, bald, shaved head. And he was like huge, like 6'5 guy with like a single.
He met Tate Fletcher that night, said it looked like him.
Yeah, Tate Fletcher. He looks like him. Sleeveless one piece leather like suit, unitar, whatever the frig it was, and like studs in his face, and he's just sitting at the bar like talking to himself, and I'm sitting next to him having a beer, and he's like, it's like literally doing that. And then he gets up from the bar and he goes to the pool table and he's like, oh, and then he runs out of the bar, and the guy at the pool table grabs his neck and he goes, he cut me. Son of a bitch, I'm going to fuck him up. I know where he lives. And it was a drug deal. They were arguing over a drug deal, and they owed him money. And he cut him across the side of the neck with a box cutter, and he starts bleeding from the neck. Now, he didn't hit the jugular, but he was bleeding a lot. And then his girlfriend's like crying. And by the way, there's a guy on stage before this playing Blowing in the Wind, like badly. Like, yeah, it's like bad, right? And I basically am like thinking, okay. And then this starts, and this guy's screaming, he cut me, and he was drunk. And they wouldn't sit down. He wouldn't shut up. He wouldn't leave the bar. They call an ambulance. The girlfriend's crying. He cut me. I'm going to fuck him. Oh, my God. Look at my boyfriend. The answer, my friend. The guy just keeps playing. Like, he doesn't stop. Like, he's been waiting a month to get up. He's not again. And so I think the show's over. And I'm doing this like a month. So I don't know that I don't have to go up. So the guy goes up, the MC, and he goes, all right. And I think he's like, that's our show. And then he goes, you guys ready for some comedy? He brings me on stage. And I say, nice to be here at Downtown Beirut, too. I always wanted to follow a slashing. And the guy hears me say slashing, and he takes all these bloody napkins that he had at me, and he goes, hey, He goes, I don't need to take any shit from you. And he takes all the bloody napkins and he throws them at me. And they stick to my shirt.
Your white shirt.
My white Brooks Brothers shirt with a... Now, I get rid of the... I said it, and again, I think I have to stay. And now I'm like, fuck this. I'm going to stay. This guy can kiss my ass. So I just get rid of the bloody stain. And I got like a grapefruit-sized blood stain right on my rib cage, on my Jesus. Right side of my ribs. And I keep going. I keep going. And he's like, now the cops are there. Their walkie-talkies are on. So it's like five things go. It's like a cacophony of just like, it's like,
Blenders going.
Blenders are going. 86 and 9. He caught me, man. Look at my boyfriend. Hey, two guys walk into a bar. Like, it's fucking, I'm complete cluster. And he turns back to me. He goes, hey, you still doing jokes? He goes, what are you doing? I go, I'm trying to tell jokes. He goes, all right, hang on. He goes,
This is the guy with the slash thing.
He goes, I could use some jokes. He turns back to the bar. He goes, hey, everybody, shut the fuck up. This guy's trying to tell jokes. And the whole place shuts up. It's a good hear. You could hear a pin drop, right? And I had the best, like, 2 minutes I ever had in my life because people were scared. And I'll never forget when he would yell, he'd emphasize little bit of blood would like, squirt because of pressure of his neck. Yeah. And I get off and I go back to the firm. And I turned into like a 15-year-old boy because I know I have to go right back because I'm three hours
blood
past.
All over your shirt.
And I turned into like, you know, like when you break your mother's lamp and you like glue it back together and you think she'll never notice.
Yeah.
And she notices immediately. Yeah. I have this brainstorm of like, I'm going to walk around the firm with a file folder up against my rib cage for the next 4 hours and no one will notice this giant blood stain on my
waist. Is it like 1 a.m. now?
It's almost midnight, and the senior partner's there who's never there past 6 o'clock.
Right.
Corner office guy, gray hair, like rainmaker of the firm.
Yeah.
And this is one of these deals where it's just me and him, which is a big compliment as a junior associate. Like, they so trusted me. Like, So I walk into the room, and he's like, where have you been? Screaming at me like 20 of the lawyers in the room. What have you been doing? Why do you have a blood stain on your shirt? And I'm like, I'm dead. I'm like, I don't know what to say. And somebody goes, one of the lawyers goes, what kind of shirt is that? I go, Brooks Brothers. He goes, I know how to get blood out of a Brooks Brothers shirt. He goes, club soda and lemon juice. I'm like, what? And then he goes, the other guy goes, no, Armani. That's the shirt you want when you get blood. They started competing with each other over who had the better shirt to get blood out of, right?
That's weird.
And I just slinked out of the room. And I would just live this lie. When I told my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, that I wanted to, thinking to leave to be a comedian, she goes, thank God. I go, why? She goes, well, I thought you were cheating on me. I go, why? She goes, well, you were supposed to be at work all night. You were coming home reeking a beer and cigarette. You had blood stains on your shirt. I don't know if you were like ultimate fighting at night. I don't know what you were doing, right? And you had women's phone numbers, which were other comics who had rooms to work. And like you, so she put a completely different puzzle together, right?
How long did you keep it from her?
2 years.
Oh. All right, take a quick break. Paul McCure, I'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Adam Carolla.
And this is Dr. Drew.
And after you enjoy this podcast, how about you check out our podcast, The Adam and Dr. Drew Show.
Wait a minute. You mean we're back together again?
Oh, man.
I know. I'm sorry.
People. Like Randy and Ty. Either way, we talk sex, drugs, relationships, life choices, everything under the sun. And you can subscribe at The Adam and Dr. Drew Show for new episodes every Sunday and Thursday, completely free. As well.
Only on Corolla Digital. It's like old times. Good times.
We can cut that part out.
Dr. Podcast. I'm having part two of the Paul Mercurio story.
We're swinging, baby.
Paul Mercurio Show is the iTunes, the podcast available on iTunes
like
and
this.
Paul's website. Yeah, we got three albums for you. At Paul Mercurio, M-E-C-U-R-I-O, no R, paulmercurio.com. And why did you keep it from her?
I was very – you have to understand that –
You were ashamed of it?
I came from a very straight background, right? Yeah. Blue-collar parents, sort of blue-collar, traditional education. I was now a lawyer, doctor, banker. I was now like at the top of the food chain of whatever, right?
Yeah.
And this was like a frivolous, silly thing that I was too embarrassed to tell anybody. I was embarrassed. And if the firm found out, they would have given me an ultimatum of like, you either stop or you have to leave. Because, I mean, I was, another time, smallish room, about to go on. My wife's, the wife of one of the senior partners walks in with her girlfriends, girls' night out, to have dinner in the restaurant, but you had to like to go on stage. You had to walk through the restaurant. I'm like, holy shit! So I'm now hiding behind the bar. Like this is like right out of a cigarette, right? And they go, what? What's the matter? I go, tell him to announce me as Peter Dodd. And I made up a name. It was the first name of one friend and the last name of another. What? Just tell him to introduce me as Peter Dodd. And I'm going to go. There's a back entrance. I'm going to go out the back entrance. So I went through the kitchen,
wow,
around the back. And I wore my overcoat on stage so she wouldn't see that I had a suit on.
Wow.
And I go on stage, and she's in the back, and the whole time all I'm doing is looking at her table. I'm looking at her table, and I'm standing sideways to the audience so she wouldn't see my full face.
Wow.
And I did my whole set standing sideways to the audience.
Wow.
And I didn't get caught, but it was like getting hairier and hairier and hairier. And then I finally said, you know, I either got to shit or get off the pod here, you know.
Did you have any experiences where people were sort of would give you shit about what you were doing?
You mean
like anybody that did find out or did know?
No. One comic found out that I worked on Wall Street, and he started asking to borrow money from
me. Oh, of course.
You know what I mean? There was that thing, you know, and like he wanted to know what kind of stuff I would work on, and I couldn't say because it was all secret. Like all the stuff had we had code deal code names for everything. You know the way you build stuff because you. You couldn't let it go public until you had everything ready.
Right.
So it was very secretive, you know? And but it was really hard. I was just embarrassed to tell anybody that I was doing it.
If I could share with you, I'm just realizing that my relationship with radio was very much like what – that's why I didn't use my real name. I didn't want people to know it was me. I just wanted to do it because I thought it was important.
And what was – was there like the creative thing that went for me?
It was a little both. Yeah, it was little like just not being happy, just doing one – you know, I needed to do something – something more creative. I don't know what it was. And so the opportunity to talk to lots of people and educate them to me was extremely compelling.
But that to me is a noble gesture. Why would you feel like I'm
because
just telling frivolous
joke? I was stepping out of line. I was talking about sex. It was 30 years ago and you're talking about sex and I was in training and you're not the guy, the young.
AIDS yet? AIDS?
Oh, that's what got me in.
Yeah.
I wanted to educate about AIDS.
But
I
it's taboo to talk. Yeah.
Well, you don't tell young people to put a condom on. Young people aren't having sex. Why would you talk to them? I mean, that's the attitude back then.
Yeah.
And I knew differently. And I had different instincts, and I didn't want it to disrupt what I was doing in medicine. I just wanted to be able to do this little creative outlet.
Yeah, and that's what I thought this was going to be.
I get the feeling. Me too. You know, here we are. Right?
I really thought this was my golf. Like everybody else was golfing.
I had the exact same feeling. But for me, it was also like I have no social life. I can't get out of the hospital, but it gives me a little social life. You know, I get to meet some people.
Yeah,
and I had the same kind of weird. I expected it not. It takes over.
Yeah,
but you don't make it take
well,
over.
Well, here's the thing that happens. I think people think, oh, you wake up and, oh, yes, I just turned it all away and worked.
No.
It creeps up on you and it creates an incredible, for me, amount of emotional stress because now you start thinking, should I do this? Should I not do this? This is so scary. And it's the worst place to be for me.
I had the same experience because me was like – it was not for the same reasons, but similar phenomena, which was, you know, is it appropriate? I really want to be a good doctor, and I really value that. I don't want to let that go. And
I think if I were like a shyster lawyer, like,
that
would be like, well, this was like literally in a tower on the 50th floor overlooking Central Park. And then I would get in a car and I'd end up at the Bowery where a guy is drinking who you gave money to on the street earlier.
But you had developed, worked extremely hard to develop the trust, goodwill, faith, and admiration of your superiors.
Right.
And your peers.
Right.
And that means that's what you were risking. I think
that's right. And I hadn't thought about that until you just said it, but you're exactly right. Like I was the favored one in a way. Like I was definitely on a good track, as they say, you know. And
you were letting them down, letting your parents down.
And how could I explain that to my father, whose knees were the size of basketballs from putting floors in for 30 years, that I was going to stop being a lawyer? And, you know, I have a picture this day of he and my mother and I standing in front of the courthouse in downtown where I just gotten sworn in after passing the bar. I got so drunk after I passed the bar that night. My friend had a creative black tie party in New York City, and he lived in a walk-up apartment on 77th Street and 2nd Avenue across from the Mad Hatter. I got so hammered that I ended up in the bathroom. I was in a tuxedo, and I sat on the toilet seat just to sit, and I passed out in the toilet. And it was only one bathroom, and they couldn't get into the room because I locked the door.
Oh no!
And so somebody's at the party goes, "Hey, there's a skylight. Let's go up on the roof and we'll drop into it." But it's snow. They're like, "No, you can't do that." So my friend Pete Sherlock takes a running start, like 30 feet. It's a hollow door, and he punches a hole in the door and unlocks the door, and they pull me out of there, and I'm passed out on this guy's couch, and just the worst hangover. But I passed the bar on the first try in New York, and I was like, and I was there, you know, and I just think all of that. You're right. I had
you
those
worked
people.
So hard for that, you know. And
that's
you
the
worked,
first yeah. thing that everybody said to me yeah. when I told them in my personal life that I was going to do it. Yeah. You work so hard. Yeah. To get there. Like, they saw how hard I worked in college and then also worked that family business job. And
this,
then
by the way, we should air this as a take a knee episode for Adam, by the way. But go ahead, yes.
And I basically just, you know, if someone said to me, would you do it again? I probably would, but I say probably only because of the emotional toll that it took on me as I was trying to figure out what to do with my life. Mm. It was brutal. I was at the point where, like, if you're walking down the street and you seemed reasonable to me, I'd walk up to
you. Start talking about it.
I was just asking everybody and anybody for advice because I didn't have the balls to make the decision.
Now, you end up – let's take it forward to the rooming house.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I have a two-bedroom apartment co-op, beautiful doorman, old pre-war building, 50 feet that I own, 50 feet from the Museum of Natural History. And my Saab and my gold cufflinks and my everything else, and I say, I'm going to do this. And by the way, in the middle of trying to make this decision, my father dies of a heart attack. I go home to Rhode Island. My mother wants me to run the family business. I try that for a while. That doesn't work. But that's a story for a whole other podcast and another day. And there's a whole bunch of stories there. So because at that point, I thought that's what I was supposed to do. And then that wasn't it. And I was completely freaked out. So I leave and I sell my apartment on the Upper West Side.
Are you still doing comedy while you're trying to run the furniture store?
No, I stopped completely. Yeah. Yeah. And that was a whole other thing. Yeah. But and I moved back, and I go back to work. I kind of took a leave of absence from Wall Street, try to run this business. I go back. I'm like, screw it. I'm going to leave. I'm going to do it. I do it. I sell my apartment because I can't afford to keep it. It was eating up to my – and I sell everything that's worth anything. I sell my big TV. I sold – like I had a – we were super nice high-end stereo with like vacuum tubes and all that stuff. I sold that like at like a third of what I paid, and I just amassed the money, and I moved to a rooming house outside the city in Queens, and it was literally like in those old film noir movies where it's like the 40s and Philip Marlowe goes to the house where the bad guy lives and it's like a bare light bulb and it's like it's creaky floors and rats are running through it. That's what this house was. It was a German couple that owned this house. It was a big Victorian house, first floor they had, and they had all these little rooms partitioned off, 10 by 12 room with a hot pot on the floor and a little bureau. That was my room with one window, and we shared kitchens and bathrooms with the other tenants. And the other tenants were two recovering addicts, two guys on parole, an alcoholic tow truck operator, a super, super gay guy that would run around in like short jean shorts. And the alcoholic tow truck operator didn't like him, so he'd like bitch slap him in the hallway and they'd start like he'd start crying. And then the guy I'm lying in my bed. And my direct neighbor above me was a 300-pound phone sex operator who sold Herbalife diet products door to door. And that's where
I was
living.
She knows what the Holocaust is.
And that was like, that's where I was
living.
And
you'd have to listen to her calls.
Yeah. And the problem is it's, you know, theater of the mind. You know, we talked about this. And what you do is you call in. I don't know if anybody out there's done phone sex, but you call into a general number, 1-800-whatever, and it's like a Chinese menu. And you can order what you want. And there's a price attached. You know, I want the woman to say blankety blank and do it, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And you go to town. And then she calls you. And I'd hear like, hi, yeah, this is Carol. And that was true. And I have strawberry blonde hair. And this is true. And I have blue eyes. And that's true. And I weigh 105 pounds. Thank you for playing. Thank you for playing. There are parting gifts. And she would then proceed to do some of the most graphic things. And I was in this little apartment. And it'd be like February. And I would have to walk outside in the neighborhood or go for a drive. Usually I just walk around the neighborhood for like 20 minutes until she was done.
I think she needs to be the next character on The Last Man on Earth. The Last Man was – what was the one? The Will Forte?
Last Man on Earth.
She'd be a great next character to come along.
And then she'd wear a giant muumuu and a big button that said, "I'm an herbal lifer. How about you?" So during the day, she would knock on people's doors selling diet products while she was doing phone sex at night.
And how could she sell diet products with her weight issues? It's so weird.
And then the other guy that lived there for a while, but then he moved, was Bobby, not my cousin. He was a gay cook who was a raging alcoholic who came out later in life. He was a grandfather, and he was like 110 pounds soaking wet. So one night, there was a stoop. You'd have to like go down four sets of steps to get into my entrance of my apartment, and you'd have to go up four sets of steps to get into his. So there's like an 8-foot drop from his landing to mine. So he decides, well, it's garbage night. It's Sunday, and he's going to take the garbage out. But he's drunk, and he's skinny, and he's not strong, and he has a giant green 32-gallon, those big, like you put leaves in, plastic bag filled with magazines.
Oh, jeez.
You know, magazines are heavy and slippery, and it was a huge amount. He takes the bag, and he slings the bag over the shoulder. The weight of the bag takes him over the railing and down into my stoop.
Oh, my God.
And he whacks his head, and he's bleeding.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, this is where I am in my life, right?
With the phone sex operator upstairs.
With the phone sex operator. So I get him up and I get him back and I go, "Bobby, just lie down on the couch. Don't go to the second," because he had like two levels in his thing. He goes, all right. So 2 minutes later, I'm downstairs. What do I hear? He's trying to walk up the steps. Boom, boom. Oh, shit. So... it's becoming bad. Now, I'm working gigs. I'm getting stiffed on money. I worked one gig where they didn't have any heat in the club for 5 shows to pay me $250. I get off stage at the end of the week, and we were literally doing shows, and everybody was in there. Elaine Boozle was the main act. It was in Hartford, Connecticut, New Haven, Connecticut, called Joker's Wild. It's a better club now, owned by a different guy. The guy who owned it was a drug dealer named John, and he called me a pussy because I wouldn't do shots with him and lines of coke before the show. These are people who would not been allowed to Xerox to copy documents in my previous life, right? Yeah. And so basically, I get off stage, and the guy goes, the bouncer, because he's not here. The owner left. He didn't leave you a check, and he stiffed me. And this became my life, and I got really depressed quickly. Mm. Then I got audited by the IRS.
Oh, my God, because you dropped your income so fast.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Now, I had all these doubts, and the auditor became the personification of all of my doubts.
Like, what the fuck are you doing? Why is this?
Exactly. So I would go in.
They came and audited me, and I lose so much money practicing medicine, they didn't believe I wasn't
right. And it's the only time in your life when someone legally can go through 5 years of your life like carte blanche, and you have to answer the questions. Yeah. So he'd go through, and he'd rifle through, and he'd go, let me see this. You had like, well into 6 figures, and then you're a loss. What happened? Investments? No, I was a lawyer and investment banker, and I left to be a comedian. Yeah, right. Seriously. Yeah. What'd you do with the money?
Yeah.
No, I would say, Yeah. I had to have my lawyer come with me and attest that I was telling was true. But he became like, "You're right." Like, he literally said to me, "What person in their right mind would do this?" You have to understand, he's an IRS auditor. He was probably a C student in accounting.
Yeah.
This is the job he could get. Nothing against IRS auditors out there, but you know what I mean? It's like a government. So I'm like, "Oh, he's right. I got to go back. I got to go back. This was wrong. I gave it up. Yeah. I gave it up. Don't go away." Like, I could it's a sailboat going off into the sunset farther and farther away from me. Freaking out.
And you see your friends making more and more money.
So I go to my friend's house, who now this is he just bought like a mini mansion in Greenwich, Connecticut. And this is a guy who was like barely, you know, my equal. And I go into his house and I could not function at this party. Like, I'm just standing around and I'm just like looking at people, but I'm hearing like, wah, wah, wah. But like, because all I'm thinking is, I could have had this. I'm living below a fucking phone sex operator. I got a tow truck operator slapping the shit out of another guy. I literally went into the bathroom for 20 minutes and I sat on the toilet seat and I almost started crying, but I just sat on the toilet seat and was just like, "I got to pull it together. You got to go back out there." But I couldn't go back out there. I'm like, I got to fix this. And then I had this thing like, I'm going to go and I'm going to talk to my friend and see if he'll bring me. No, I can't ask him at the party. I got to get back. And I started to sweat.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I made the biggest mistake of my life. And then I went home and went back to my rooming house. And 2 days later, I woke up one morning. It had been raining all night. And my Saab, which was the only thing I still had left, a remnant of my Wall Street days, was under 4 feet of salt water. Because I lived by the Long Island Sound. And this storm just stayed for like 2 days. And it flooded over. And our parking lot for our house was in a dipped, like down below.
Shit.
And I like, so picture you're walking down the beach. And it's like, oh, there's a nice couple holding hands. And there's a kid playing Frisbee. There's my car in fucking 4 feet of water. Like, I'm in my room looking out the window, and the night before I had had Kentucky Fried Chicken and left the bag on the floor. The bag was now floating at the level of the dashboard, just moving back and forth. So I go, all right, I put my like little thin sweatpants on from JCPenney or whatever, and I'm going to go in and just walk in. Literally, it
start
was like
breast
and start my car and drive it out. And then I realized it's February. It's how can I even start it? So I call a tow truck company, and the guy goes, yeah, yeah. He goes, I know what's going on. I told him it's a flood. He goes, yeah, we can't. We need a professional diver to come in.
Holy shit.
To go under, because the water, they'll get hypothermia. Now, I have to tell you something. When you have car problems, you never want to hear the words professional diver.
I've never and heard them associate with car anything.
Right. So the guy's like, he's like, we got to go. He has to go in and hook the car. I can't let one of my guys walk in. He goes, you're just going to have to wait till the water recedes, till the tide goes down. So it's still raining. It's like 6 or 7 hours later, and my car's still underwater. It's salt water. And I finally, it goes down, it goes down, it goes down. And I'm just like, this is it. I'm done. I'm done. I take the car. I take it to be cleaned. And the guy goes, "You go look, it smelled disgusting because it was like, you know.
Brine.
Ugh. And he goes, look, you can drive this because I don't know how long it's going to last you because everything's going to get corroded from the salt. So I'm in the midst of having the worst doubts of my life. And I would drive at night down the street with my lights on. But because of the corrosion, the lights would start flickering. And so people coming the other direction.
Start flashing their lights back.
Start flashing their lights back. And it was like their lights were Morse code for like, what have you done with your life? You're a loser.
You're an asshole.
Go back. You idiot. Wow. You're a moron. And I couldn't escape it. I couldn't. It was just bang, bang. It was like a boxer. Just I was just getting hit to the solar plexus. Bang, bang, bang. Buddy of mine is starting in a new department in a Bear Stearns. And he says, what are you doing? He calls me up. I go, I'm doing this thing. He goes, well, he goes, you want to need some money? I'm like, yeah. I go, and I'm really at the point now where the audit, this and that, I'm like.
Tapped out.
And he goes, well, why don't you come in? And I'm like, I don't know. All right. I go buy a suit. And suddenly I'm standing on a subway platform with a newspaper under my arm and my suit and a briefcase looking like everybody else at 7:30 in the morning going for a job interview. And I don't know what I'm doing. And I go and I interview and I do well. And I got to have the callbacks interviews. I nail all those. I get a job offer.
Shit.
And at the same time that I got the job, about a few months earlier, I had done my first TV show as a stand-up. It was one of those showcase shows, you know. But I had forgotten about it. I get the job. I don't know what to do. 2 weeks. I take every minute of the 2 weeks. What am I going to do? And then long story short, I take the job, you know, and I'm like, I pick up the phone and I call my girlfriend and I'm like, I just took the job and I start crying. She goes, what are you crying about? I go, I just took a huge job and I don't want it and I don't know where to, I feel like I got these two big guns and I don't know where to shoot them. I know I got talent in two different areas. I don't really know where I want to be. It was the most lowest part of my point in my life probably because I felt so lost. I take the job, I move my girlfriend back, recreate my life, get a new two-bedroom apartment, buy a new TV, buy new cufflinks, the whole nine yards, swear off comedy. 2 months later, I'm back doing comedy like an alcoholic looking for a drink. Fast forward a couple more months, I'm doing HMO merger deals.
Jeez.
And I do one for Pinnacle West in Arizona. And I walk into the room, and it's this really, the CEO was a really nice guy, older gentleman in his 60s. And he says in front of like five other bankers and lawyers, he goes, did I see you on TV last night? I'm like, no. He goes, yeah, yeah, you were telling jokes or something. No, no. He goes, yeah, yeah, you were. I'm like, no. He goes, that show that I aired, they shot, they aired it.
Yeah.
And I forgot about it. And I'm like, oh, I am fucked.
Yeah.
He goes, yeah. He goes, I go, yeah, that was me. And he goes, that was great. He goes, hey, everybody, my investment banker is a comedian. How cool is that? Hey, Sal, he calls his assistant and he goes, isn't there a club downtown? Let's get everybody come out to see him.
Club.
I'm like, no. I'm good.
Whoa.
And that was the moment where I said, I got to go back. Mm. And I found out later, and I became his favorite. And I found out later it was because it humanized me to him.
Yeah, of course.
I wasn't just a banker looking for money.
Of course.
And that gave me the permission in a weird way that I needed, that I think I was seeking.
Well, yeah. Now you had the approval of your peers and permission.
Yeah. And
that's good.
I just didn't know that I needed it.
So you end up writing. Well, I've got to take it all the way forward now. You end up writing for the Daily Show and the Colbert Show, and you walk around the halls of the Colbert Show one day, and Paul McCartney is the guest.
Yeah, and Paul is standing in the hallway all alone after rehearsal, and in the hallway all alone, and he basically had just finished the rehearsal. So I'm walking through and I see Paul McCartney. I'm like, oh my God, it's Paul McCartney. And in my mind, I'm like, oh my God, it's Paul McCartney. And he's all slow motion. Like,
what is this?
And I basically say, should I say hi to him? Should I not say hi to him? And then I'm like, screw it. He's like all alone in the hallway. He's like a gazelle on the Serengeti Plains. I'm going to pounce. And I go up. I go, hey, it's nice to meet you. Hey, what's your name? Paul. Oh, Paul, that's a good name. What do you do? I'm a comedian. Oh, I like stand-up. I can't do a British accent, so I just raise my voice and make it sound like I am. And it basically goes, we're talking 5 minutes, 10 minutes, normal people. And then on the outside, I'm like all smooth and hip, you know, like your swing music.
Yeah.
But on the inside, I'm like, I'm talking to Paul McCartney. And I basically, he goes, I leave and I go into the bathroom. I say bye to him.
You have a lot of important experiences in the bathroom.
I do. And I go, to this day, I get in my headset, in my mindset.
Like going to the bathroom.
I go into the bathroom, into the stall, and I just get like mini meditation for a minute. And I call my girlfriend at the time, my wife actually, and I say, hey, she goes, where are you? I go, I'm in the bathroom at the Colbert Report. She goes, what are you doing? Are you jerking off? I'm like, no. I go, no, it's not Tuesday. She goes, no, I just called Paul McCartney. You're not going to believe it, blah, blah, blah. And then I hang up because I'm delusional. I go, he should do my podcast. Like, I don't even know if he knows what a podcast is. And by the way, when I talked to him, I was getting super close to his face because, like, he's iconic.
Yeah.
I was like that chimp on the National Geographic channel, like, that cleans ticks off its mate. Like, I could have cleaned this up. I was, like, way too close, right? And I go back to his dressing room. I go, would you do my podcast? He goes, yeah, sure, just like that. Yeah. Now, you're like, when you're in high school, is that hot chick you want to ask out? You think she'll say no, just get it over with and get it out of your system and you're done with it? Instead, she says yes and you don't have a plan.
Yeah.
That was me.
Yeah.
He goes, yeah, sure. How would we do it? I'm like, I'll come to London. And he's like, we're in New York together. What's wrong with you? And then I go, he goes, is it easy to do? And I actually said to Paul McCartney, yeah, it's really easy. It's really easy. You could do it on your phone naked from your toilet. I'm like, what am I saying? Like, if this were first date, she would have been gone by the app before the appetizer hit the table. So I go, look, I'll leave you alone, and I'll go talk to your assistant and set it up. He goes, nah, they'll muck it up. This is the mind blow right here. He goes, you and I'll do it. Let's just give me your number, and we'll call each other. We'll figure it out. What? He goes, yeah, we'll just do it directly. So I give him my number, and the phone, and he does the show, and he's amazing on the show. And he leaves. I leave. I'm heading to the Daily Show with the taping. My phone rings. I don't recognize the number. I let it ring the voicemail, and this is the message on my phone.
Paul, it's Paul McCartney here. I'm going to ring you back in 5 minutes to do the podcast thing. Yeah. I've got some time now. Otherwise, I'm going to run out of time. So if you're there in 5 minutes' time, you got me. Okay, bye.
Does that count as me engineering a Paul McCartney vocal track?
Yes, it does.
All right.
It does.
I thought I did something wrong. I saw Gary drop his head. I was like, oh, geez, did I just like...
No, not at all.
I was just like, wow, I get this message. And I'm like, holy... Now, I retrieved the message in the middle of the street in New York City. And if you saw me from afar, you would have thought, well, I was a homeless guy talking his voices on my head because I just started screaming. Shit! Shit, I just screened the call. Paul McCartney screened the call. And I just ranted for 5 minutes. And then I called and got a line and got him on the phone.
Awesome.
And the last thing they said before I got on the phone is, please hold, Paul's in the bathroom. And all I could picture was wow, Paul McCartney, he must take a genius shit. He's the most genius person ever, right?
Even his shits are genius.
Tell him not to flush it.
Yeah, exactly. It goes backwards down the toilet and it says Paul's alive or something. And it just became, and then he got on the phone.
I wonder how many youngsters know that one.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
You know what he's talking about? No. Yeah. They have no idea.
Yeah.
And on I'm the Walrus, is that the song?
Yeah.
What's the name of that song?
They say if you play one of their songs backwards.
I'm the Walrus. It backwards, it says it's John or somebody saying
John.
Paul is dead.
Paul is dead. And so that's – and he did it and we jumped on and it was like – and then again, it was one of those things where I'm talking to Paul McCartney, but I'm not talking to Paul McCartney. I'm just having a conversation with somebody. It was just like my mind was going a million miles.
I have a million more stories I'd like to fill out with you in terms of the experience of The Daily Show. We do a part three.
Yeah.
So we'll do it on your podcast. We'll do it on your podcast. Yeah. Part three, they want a part three or two. They're asking for it. But we can't do it now. I got to get going. And
you guys are asking for it too, boy.
That's what he just
I feel
said,
like I'm boring the shit out of you guys. I'm sorry.
Can you talk about what you're working on right now? And then
I got a scripted half hour show that we're developing for Warner Brothers.
About all this?
With the writer at Warner Brothers and
a very famous writer.
Yeah, John Rigi and a guy named Don Scardino, and they're really excited about it.
You're going to be able to see this as this is the next Mad Men.
Yeah,
you're hearing it first here.
You guys are in it, man. You're in it. Don't worry about it.
There's going to be a scene where you're telling it in a podcast. It's going to be the opening of every show.
I got to have a podcast on the show.
We'll cut from his face to you guys, mouth open, listening to this amazing story.
and so we are now working on sort of the core of the show and what we want the focus to be. The focus will be a guy. Really want to hit the human side of this, which is a guy who thinks he's got his life figured out, but he doesn't. Because in talking about this on the road and in my act, I have a lot of people coming up to me after the show going, I'm in the same boat. I'm doing this, but I want to do that. So
yeah, it's got to be a lot of people. That's why Adam did that Take a Knee podcast, is because this, you know, it's really sort of a common thing. My kids are going through it now. You're finding their way.
Yeah.
Oh, adamcarolla.com/archives for details on Take a Knee. Is that right? Okay. That's what they do. That he interviews people about their careers and lives.
Oh,
and stuff.
Cool!
And this would be a great.
Yeah, I'd love to.
He should listen to this. Hey, Adam would love this stuff. This is very different than normally. He's dealing with people that just are sort of dealing with childhood adversity and then overcoming.
Oh.
But this right? Would you say? I mean, a lot of that kind of stuff.
It's a wide range of people. You know, RZA from Wu-Tang, Mel Brooks, Norman Lear, Terry Crews, the actor. But I mean, there's a lot of. What Adam's finding is there's common themes in almost every successful person's story.
Yeah, yeah.
But adamcarolla.com/archive, it's only a couple bucks a month. You get a new Take a Knee every Monday and access to every Adam Carolla show in the history of the show.
Yeah, that'd be awesome to do that with him. But I don't know. I just found my way like slowly. And then I still have doubts sometimes when stuff isn't going exactly the way I want.
Of course.
You know what I mean? It's like...
So far, so good.
Yeah,
Paul, thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it.
This is awesome, man. Thank you. It was therapeutic for me.
Really fun. And I'll do your podcast. We'll do it soon.
Yes.
Yeah.
You got to come back on. He was great. You can hear Dr. Drew on my podcast. We did a great episode. Paul Mercurio Show.
Oh, and my wife's show too. He was on.
Calling Out. Go listen to
Calling Out with Susan Pinsky. It's actually a really fun podcast.
So. She does a great job as a host. She's very sweet.
All right. Take care, guys. See you soon.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. This is Corolla Digital.